God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, the courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Amen. The Simple Actions Group wishes to extend a warm welcome to all in attendance today. Newcomers, is there anyone here in their first 30 days of sobriety? We would just like to welcome you. Just throw your blue hand up. I'm going to allow people to unmute themselves. BJ?
My name is BJ. I'm an alcoholic.
BJ, welcome. Glad you're here. Anybody else? First 30 days?
Hi, my name's Caroline. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Caroline. Welcome.
Thanks.
Anybody else?
Hi, David. It's Tracy.
Hi, Tracy. Are you first 30 days?
Nope.
Okay. Welcome.
For the grace of God, nope, not this time.
I'm Anna. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Anna. Welcome.
Thank you.
Anybody else? First 30 days?
Glad y'all are here.
All right. All right, thank you. I don't have any females hosting. Lynn, could I make you a co-host? I saw her mouth move. She said, sure. So Lynn, basically the meeting is set up. You can chat with hosts only. So, and I didn't hear any men in the first 30 days, but if there's any men looking for phone numbers, just send me a message. Any women looking for phone numbers, please send a chat message to Lynn. I'm grateful you're all here. So the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous states that Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. So the way this is going to go, the format of this meeting, it's an open speaker / ask it basket tonight. We're very excited to welcome Ray S. from Mount Pleasant, South Carolina, to tell his story. And after he does that, we will allow him a break and we'll call for announcements and the seventh tradition, et cetera, at the top of the hour. And then we'll ask questions of the speaker. You'll notice if you have your participants tab open, you'll see a user at the top called Questions. That's actually Larry. And so as you think of questions during the meeting or at the top of the hour, it doesn't matter. Please feel free to chat your questions to Larry, and then we'll get them queued up. We'll reconvene, and then we'll ask Ray the questions at the top of the hour. So I don't want to take up any more of his time. Absolutely thrilled to have him here. I give you Ray.
Great. Thank you so much. I'm really excited to be here. First of all, I want to thank David for contacting me and giving me the opportunity to tell my story. And I want to thank Harmony for planting a seed about that. And I hope that during my story, if you don't know Harmony, that I can share some Harmony-isms with you that may be fun for you to throw back at her at a later date. But she is I'm a big fan of hers and Grant and her mom. And, you know, we've got a Minnesota connection. So I'm really glad to be here. And I'm really excited to speak to the newcomers. I heard BJ, Caroline, and Anna. And I'm also really excited to speak to anyone who has gotten sober during this pandemic. And I just think that you guys are rock stars. I think you're heroes. You know, you'll hear a lot of people talk about, I don't know if I could have done it. You know, that's really not up to them. It'd really be up to God. But But for you guys to get sober during this time, man, I just think that that's tremendous. And I have the utmost in respect for you. And I hope that soon that you'll be able to see the true spirit of Alcoholics Anonymous in the fellowship of being at meetings with other sober members. You know, we've got an old joke I took from Minnesota. It's like, you know, if you're new, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. The good news is you never have to drink again. The bad news is we're your 57 of your new friends. So welcome. My sobriety date is January 19th, 1987. I have a home group in Mount Pleasant here. It's the happy hour group. We meet at 6:30 every Thursday. And right now we're meeting outside in a pavilion behind the church where we're practicing social distancing. And we have masks that are optional. And we have sanitation opportunities available for people. And it's been really good to really reconnect with people in that fellowship. I have a sponsor. His name is Bob Darrell. He's based out of Las Vegas, Nevada. I've had quite a few sponsors in sobriety. And this is my second time around with Bob. And if he plays his cards right, I'll continue to work with him. That's a joke, if you know Bob. So I've been sponsored to speak to, you know, what it was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. So the way I share is I basically do a third step prior to sharing. I ask God to speak through me if it be his will. I ask to be present, I ask to be honest, and I ask to be able to reach someone who needs help in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then that's it, man. There's no script other than my name, sobriety date, and my home group and my sponsor. So what it was like is, you know, pretty typical. I grew up in Minnesota, northeastern Minnesota, Duluth, Minnesota, right on the shores of Lake Superior, largest freshwater lake in the world. And at 14 years old, I was one of those kids that was hanging out in the neighborhood who had, for whatever reason, had the utmost respect and admiration for the kids that were hanging out that were 2 or 3 or 4 years older than us. And, you know, they were our source. You know, I grew up in an alcoholic home. Doesn't make me an alcoholic, but it certainly does put some ism in my life. And I saw active alcoholism as a young age. And I saw physical violence in my home at a young age. And I think that I tend to think that other than the genetic aspect of alcoholism, there are other things that contribute to alcoholism in the form of, you know, self-esteem, self-respect, things like that. So I took my first drink at 14 years old. It was some cheap wine. I don't even remember what it was called, but it was like this really sugary, cheap wine. And I got loaded, man. And I got loaded. I had a blast. I went home, I puked, you know, and I got together with the guys the next day and I said, you know, I went home. I got really sick. I'm never going to do that again. And I meant it. And they all looked at me like, oh, yes, you are. And I don't know how they knew, but they were absolutely right. And that kind of started my alcoholism right there. You know, I had some issues at a young age that I would prefer not to have in my life. That, you know, the alcohol was kind of drowned out. You know, I mentioned that there was physical violence in my home, and it was my oldest brother who passed away quite a while ago in Baltimore from a car accident. And my dad, who would physically fight, and one particular occasion they were physically fighting, and I ran down into our basement. You know what a basement is? Ran down into our basement, and I kind of hid in this little room, and I remember desperately wanting to be found, and I waited. And the door finally opened, and my mom opened up the door, and she looked at me, you know, and I understand why she said this, and I understand how she said it, because she was dealing with the same thing I was dealing with. But she looked at me, and she said, well, what is the matter with you? And I'll tell you, I'm 59 years old, And for most of my life, that question has plagued me. I've always thought there's something wrong with me, and I didn't know what it was. But when I drank, I was okay. And so I was off to the races just based on that at a real young age of 14. I know that Harmony was like 9 or something when she got sober, because she's got a caboodle years of sobriety. But I came in, I started hitting it at 14, and it was pretty good, man. I had a blast. It was a weekend thing in the neighborhood, you know, and we would pool our money together, and these older kids would go and buy us liquor. You know, they charged us. We bought their beer for them, but we didn't care, you know, and so it turned into an every weekend thing, and then it turned into more than that, you know, and it turned into consequences. And some of the consequences I experienced were as early as 16 years old. And it was trouble with the law and trouble with in a youth center where we used to go and, bring our booze and bring our weed, you know, and we'd go down on the railroad tracks and we'd get loaded. And then we'd go back into the youth center, you know, and, you know, it was a Christian youth center. So we're trying to pick up girls at 16, you know. And I got busted, and I was always the guy. If there was a group of guys, I was always the guy where the hand grabbed my shoulder and took me in. And the guy sat me down and questioned me and called my mom, and I went home from that incident, and she looked at me and she said, "Is what he said true?" And I said, "Yes." She said, "Oh my God, you're going to turn out to be just like your father." And that was another one of the, you know, I guess I'm a mama's boy, because that one stuck up with me too, you know. And that was like the thing I hung on to. I'm never going to be like my dad. I'm never going to be an alcoholic like my dad. You know, and when I wrote that first step in a treatment center in Center City, Minnesota, I wrote that down. You know, I'm powerless over alcohol. I promised myself I would never be like my dad. And that promise to my innermost self, I could not uphold. You know, alcohol had its grips on me. And so my dad ended up getting sober. He went through a rehab in Duluth, Minnesota, came out of there. I had this delusion that everything was going to be good. What came out of that is he got sober. He left the family, went out with a new woman that he ended up marrying later, you know. And there I was, kind of in my cups at a young age, kind of stuck with my mom. My brothers and sisters had already moved out, you know, and so it was me dealing with her hurt. It was me dealing with her fear. It was me dealing with her life while I was trying to deal with my life. I got suspended from school, no surprise, you know, Minnesota. I'd be throwing snowballs at buses, you know, they'd kick me out. I got caught smoking cigarettes, you know, I get suspended, you know. To me, it was like a 3-day weekend. It was like, you know, okay, 3 days off from school, I can deal with that. Other than the consequences at home, you know, it was fine. I got into other substances at a really young age. You know, my deal is I'm a true alcoholic. I'm a real alcoholic. I can't control when I'm going to drink. I can't control how much I'm going to drink when I start drinking. But I'll tell you, any drug that is white, I'm all about. And I was at a real young age. What does this mean? When David does this, what does this mean? Unmute yourself. What does this mean? Oh, he's not going
to. Don't stop, man. Don't stop. I was just saying right on, white.
Oh, all right. Yeah. I thought you were telling me to hurry up, man. Wrap it up.
No, dude, no.
So it's anyway, all you. So, that's all right. No worries. So, so I'd be crushing up White Cross Speed in the toilet in eighth grade and snorting it. And I just loved anything white. And that started my romance with white drugs. And that's eventually what got me into this program a lot quicker than maybe the alcohol would have. So, from there, it was just a series of, unfortunate circumstances based around my, alcoholism. It showed up and manifested in the form of not able to have normal relationships with people, losing a lot of jobs, hitting a bottom, which was You know, the thought process of as long as I can keep a job, I don't have a problem, getting to the point of losing that job. When I went home and told my mom about that drop-in center thing, she and this youth pastor decided it would be a good idea for me to go into a outpatient treatment center, which I did at a real young age. And I finished that outpatient treatment center. They never mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous. They never mentioned 12 steps. You know, it was kind of an experimental treatment center. You know, it was all about building self-esteem and kind of the issues of, you know, of your childhood and all that crap. And, but I wanted to stay sober and I made it 2 weeks and I didn't have a chance, you know, cause I was hanging out with the same people, and doing the same stuff. And, you know, they all looked at me like, oh, it's just a matter of time. And again, these guys were right. And it's just a matter of time. And I was off to the races. When I hit my bottom, I was 26 years old. I'd had a series of problems at work. I was at that time a mainframe computer operator for a large retail concern. They had 500 stores across the country. And I was responsible for training new managers how to work point of sale terminals, you know, the cash registers. And and I was really good at it, because there were like really cute, like 18-year-old store managers. And, and I had a blast. And, I used to write, documentation. So I would go in, to these terminals and I would think like an 18-year-old, store manager, and I'd mess up these transactions, then write how they can get out of it. So I was really good at it. But the problem I was having was, is I wasn't showing up for work. And when I did show up for work, I was kind of a, I was kind of an asshole. And I had a real temper problem. You know, it was only when I got into Alcoholics Anonymous that my temper problem really was fear manifesting in different ways. You know, I was really afraid. And so while I was getting all these accolades in my job, you know, I had no idea who I was and I was a mess, you know, and it got to the point where people didn't want to work with me anymore. And it got to the point where I was damaging equipment because of my anger, you know, and I look back at it now, you know, 30 some years later and just what a cry for help. You know, here's a lost kid that everyone, not everyone, but the company is saying, you're great. We love what you're doing. And I just hated myself so much for the life I was living, for the compromised values, for the morals that I was taught that I was no longer able to withhold or even try to. But I had this conscience, you know, and it got to the point where I got called into what appeared to me like an intervention, but it was just really my boss and his boss and his boss's boss. And what I heard them say was, you know, at one time you were the best employee we had in this data center, and now we don't know if we can keep you. You know, the white drugs were prevalent. The alcohol was prevalent. I was tremendously in debt. I was a really bad entrepreneur when it came to helping people with their substance acquisitions, you know. I became my own best customer, so I'm going to this credit counseling to try and figure out how to salvage, you know, all these credit card debts. People were calling me, sending me letters, you know, and I remember when this came up, it's like my thought process was, it's like, it's okay, I'm just having some personal problems. And I really believe that. Right. And I really believe that if I could get this debt off my back, if I could get this troubled relationship figured out, you know, if I could control my anger, you know, everything would be okay. So I really believe that it was personal problems, you know, and I didn't really link the alcohol and drugs seriously. I kind of suspected, you know, but again, I was not going to be an alcoholic like my dad. I was not going to do that. And so they put me on what I like to call double secret probation. It was like 90 days. I had to do like a 30-day check-in. And after the 90 days, if you're an alcoholic like me, you found reason to celebrate. So I went out to the same place I always went out to and with the same group of people, and I was only going to have a couple because I knew I had to work the next morning at 9 a.m. And so my history was, and my first step proved, that after the third drink, I have lost the choice. The compulsion takes over, the allergy kicks in, and I'm off to the races until there is no more to be had. And it happened again that night. And there were two bars in Duluth that I used to frequent. One was the Lyric, where I went, you know, kind of dressed up like the executive guy, the data center guy. And then there was the Cozy. And the Cozy was on First Street. The First Street is where the bums hung out. And the bums were my friends, right? I liked them. And the Cozy was the type of place that you used to wipe your feet on the way out. You know, you didn't want to take any of the crap with you from the Cozy. And I used to frequent the Cozy at 9 in the morning. I worked a swing shift of 9 p.m. to 9 a.m. or 9 a.m. to 9 p.m. And I would frequent the Cozy at 9 a.m. because it was open. And it was always, I'm just going to have a couple to wind down. And at 10 o'clock, the Price is Right would come on. And so I'd hang out with Bob Barker for another hour. And then the guy started showing up to shoot pool. So I'd be there all day. And this was one of those cases where I did that. And I went home, went to a party after, went home, got home like 2 or 3 in the morning. And my alarm went off. And up in northeastern Minnesota, there's times of the year, like at 8 o'clock, where it's still dark in the morning and it's dark at night. So I wasn't quite sure if it was 8 a.m. or 8 p.m. But I called the switchboard and I said, I'm running a little bit late. I'll be in a bit. Hung up the phone and I passed out. I got up at 2 in the morning, and I don't know if anyone else can relate to this, but it's just like I knew it was over. You know, I knew that I'm about to get fired. I'm tremendously in debt. I've got issues with white drugs because I can't get enough and I can't live without it. And I can't live without taking a drink because I'm so uncomfortable in my own skin. And I didn't know what to do, you know? And so what I did is I picked up a card that was left from a pastor, a local pastor that was trying to help my sister who was living with me and is now in recovery, but was suicidal at the time. And I called this guy and I said, I'm in trouble. I need some help. And I went down and visited with him. He didn't know what to do with me, but thank God he knew someone that had been recovering in Alcoholics Anonymous and whose son had gone into a treatment center, and he called that person. And while he was calling that person, I really had to pee, and I was begging this guy to let me go into the bathroom, and he finally let me go. I don't know if he thought I was going to shoot up or what I was going to do. But only in a church, I don't know if the women are going to understand this, but only in a church at a urinal is there a mirror. Usually, you know, you can write whatever on there, but there was a mirror. And I remember taking a pee and looking at myself, you know, and I look pretty prosperous today when it comes to like my health, which is a nice way of saying I'm like heavy. Man, and I was white, I was thin, I was about 160 pounds, and I was really scared when I saw myself in the mirror for the first time in a long time with a different perspective. That perspective was, as I need help. And they set me up to go into a treatment center in Center City, Minnesota. And if you don't know where that is, don't feel bad, because no one does. It's in the middle of Minnesota. It's the home of Hazelden, and I went down into Hazelden, but before I did, I had 2 weeks before I could get in. Figured out at work that I was going to take a leave of absence. I told them I was going to go get help, you know, which was great. And I spent the next two weeks just being completely blasted, including a New Year's Eve in the woods in northern Wisconsin that I could not even tell you where it was. But I was with a group of people that had everything that I needed. And I remember doing everything I needed, and I had this thought, and it was a really frightening thought, and that this isn't working anymore. And it was that moment of truth, like, this isn't doing what it used to do, you know, and what am I gonna do now? And it was a sad sad moment for me. You know, when it quit working for me, it was bad. It was really a sense of desperation that I've never experienced in my life. So I have no idea what I did over that New Year's Eve, but I understand that I had a really good time. I was putting stuff in me that I had no idea what it even was. You know, it could have been rat poison, which it, actually I think it was, but I don't know. And then I told my roommate, who was sober, which is interesting, that I'm going to go into treatment. And he said he'd drive me down, which was cool. And I called my mom, who lived out of the state, and I told her I'm going to go into treatment. And she said something that kind of rocked me again, my mom, right? And she said, well, don't worry, God will be there to help you. And this is what I told my mom. I said, you know, I refuse to believe that I'm destined to be a life of alcohol and drugs or a Jesus freak. And I said, Mom, stop with the God thing. I'm going to do it my way. I'm going to go right up the middle. And I meant it. I absolutely meant that, that I was not going to be dependent upon God. And I was not going to be dependent upon alcohol and drugs, but I was going to fix myself. And this treatment center was going to teach me how to fix myself. And so I smoked weed all the way down to Center City, Minnesota from Duluth. And I popped into there. And the first thing they asked me was, you know, does your friend want to stay? And I'm like, no, he does not want to stay. But I said, Scott, his name was Scott Golden, Harmony, if that rings a bell. I said, Scott, hang out because I'm not sure I'm going to stay. And so I went in there and I filled out the questionnaire. And they asked, you know, the infamous treatment question of when was the last time you used any substance? And I'm like, you know, 12 minutes ago. And they gave me some Librium. And I popped the Librium, and about 30 minutes later, I'm feeling pretty good. And I said to Scott, Scott, go ahead, man. This, I'm going to be fine. No problem here. And you know that, I'm not here to really talk about treatment. It's just my experience. But I know why that treatment center has a pretty good success rate and why it was good for me. And my experience there was as they treat the alcoholic and the drug addict with dignity and respect. And I had no dignity and I had no respect for myself, but these people were treating me with dignity and respect. And they were telling me that I was going to be okay, that I had a disease. And that was my introduction to the disease concept of alcoholism. And I spent the next 34 days there doing everything that they told me to do. And on the way out, you know, they made a really strong plea for me to go to a halfway house fellowship in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I said, you know, I can't. I got a job. I got to go back to my job. And they said, well, we're going to give you a contact, get a sponsor, and go to meetings. And I met a woman that came down to visit my roommate. She was in a halfway house, Marty Mann in Duluth, Minnesota, was the name of the house, Jeannie B. And she was really attractive and really smart. And she was there to see my roommate. And when she heard I was from Duluth, she said, well, look me up when you get out and I'll take you to a meeting. And I said, okay, I will. And you know, who knew what my motives were at the time, but it was like another connection into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I knew the roommate, and, you know, so we had this three thing going. And so I called her when I got out, and the next evening she picked me up to take me for a meeting. And there were four women in the car from the halfway house. And we went out to an Alano club, whatever you want to call it. And we got there a little bit late, and we walked upstairs in this building, and they were playing a movie, but it was like an old 8mm movie, and it was Bill's Story, not the one that Hallmark did or anything like that, but it was like this old archival thing, and it was so old that, you know, Bill's mouth would move, and then like 8 seconds later, the audio would come on, and I didn't understand it. You know, what I saw was a couple of old guys drinking a pot of coffee and just kind of talking. But what happened when the movie was over is they turned on the lights, and I was in a room in my hometown with about 150 other alcoholics, and I had no idea. And I'm looking around, and I'm seeing city council people, and I'm seeing prominent attorneys, and I'm seeing judges, you know, and I'm seeing normal folk, right? And I'm like, oh my God, I had no idea. And there was a meeting after. I have no idea what was said. Some kid kept on talking about, he was like double dipping about someone stealing his cigarettes. I remember that. And on the way home, Jeannie said, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, I have no plans. I don't have to go back to work for a week or so. And she says, well, we're going to go to a meeting. I'll pick you up. And she brought me to another meeting with those four other women in the car, which was kind of cool for me. And after the meeting, she said, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, I have no plans. And she said, there's a meeting at 8 o'clock. Here's the address. I'll meet you there. And I showed up at 8 o'clock and she met me there. And every meeting that I went to with her, she introduced me to a bunch of people. You know, she was my entry into Alcoholics Anonymous in my hometown. And after the third or fourth meeting, she said, well, what are you doing tomorrow? And I said, well, I'm not stupid. I'm sure I'm going to go to a meeting. And she said, yes, it's at this time, this place, and I'll meet you there. And I showed up in this meeting, and this might sound really trivial, but it kind of gives you an idea of where I was at, physically, spiritually, emotionally. I walked down the steps into this meeting, and someone says, hey, Ray. And it just stunned me. It's like someone knew my name. You know, doesn't that seem trivial? You know, but at that moment, it was like, oh my God, you know, someone knows my name. And I've been around a long time, and I've heard a lot of stories, and I've heard a lot of people talk about when they got to AA, they didn't want to be like us or them, right? When I got to AA, I felt like I was home. I felt like, oh my God, there's people here who understand me. Oh my God, there's people here that want to help me. Oh my God, there's people that want to be my friends. You know, and they asked me out for coffee. And we went, my home group became Monday night out in Lester Park at a United Methodist Church. You know, that was my very first home group. And there was a group of guys that would go out after. And there was Coca-Cola John. He was the Coca-Cola distributor. You know, there was, I can't remember his name, but he sold meat. You know, so it was like Meat Frank, we called him. You know, there was Cliffy, who was an old crotchety old guy who used to piss off his sponsor because he drank near beer. You know, and Bruce B. And these guys would take me to this little ice cream place, Bridgman's Ice Cream. And I'd get a scoop of ice cream and I'd be drinking coffee. And I started laughing so hard that I thought I was going to pee my pants. And I remember driving home from that. And this just still rocks me today. And I, first time in a long time, that I felt like truly everything was going to be okay. And I hung on to these guys like nothing. And they were funny. And they were funny as hell, and I loved it. I've got a warped sense of humor. I'm sarcastic as hell. My sponsor taught me about sarcasm, the Latin form of ripping of flesh. I'm really good at it, you know. But they became my tribe, man, and that became my home group. And they were my entry into Alcoholics Anonymous. And Jeannie B was my entry into Alcoholics Anonymous. And so when I'm sitting in my home group or standing at my home group, or I'm even on a Zoom call and I see someone new come in, I remember what it was like when someone said, hey, Ray, you know, and I want to be that cat. I want to be that guy that remembers someone's name on their second, third meeting. And I want them to have the same experience that I had when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was a fellowship. That was acceptance. You know, sometimes I think we forget, and if Harmony didn't warn you, here I go. Sometimes I think we forget what our entry like Alcoholics Anonymous was like. Because maybe we've worked through the steps. Maybe we've studied the big book, right? Maybe we think we know what's up. Maybe we think we've got really good sobriety. But what are we doing to help the newcomer get into Alcoholics Anonymous? And with COVID, what are we doing to get BJ connected into Alcoholics Anonymous? You know, so down here in the South and out in California, you know, I've been in AA in different places. You know, there's this customary, let's take a meeting schedule and everyone put their phone number on it. I only called one number in 33 years of sobriety, and that's when I moved to Hilton Head and I needed a new sponsor, and the guy shared, and it was like he was talking right at me. So I went up to him after and I said, is this your number? Can I call you tomorrow? He said, sure. But why don't we grab their number? What would it take for us to grab the newcomer's number and call them? Why do we expect them to reach out? You know, I mean, there was this time when it was like, well, if they really want to get sober, you know, they'll call me. It's like, well, I don't know. I don't know if I subscribe to that anymore. So I'm like rabid on newcomers, on men. Like, man, there's a newcomer in my home group. I grab his number. I call him the next day. He's not going to pick up. I know that. But I leave a message and I call him every day until by mistake he picks up, right? And then I just say, hey, you want to get some coffee? You got a sponsor? What can I do to help, right? So anyway, I digress a little bit. So as I mentioned, you know, I've had really blessed sobriety. You know, I went through two sponsors before I found a long-term sponsor. My first sponsor, Ed M., brought me as far as he was willing to take me. My next sponsor, Dickie B., looked like Peabody from Sherman and Peabody, if you remember that cartoon, his short little guy, big forehead, right? Brought me through the steps. And then there was always this cat that I always wanted to be my sponsor. But when I went to the Wednesday night basic text meeting and they said, anyone willing to be a sponsor, raise your hand, he never raised his hand. And I knew he was sponsoring a busload of guys. And so finally, one day out of desperation, and I've had plenty of desperation and sobriety, thank God, because it always brings me to a deeper understanding of my higher power. You know, when my sponsees say, I'm really struggling right now, I'm really having a hard time with this, or I'm really conflicted with this, I say, that's where we meet God. And it just kind of shuts them up. But it's true, too. So I'm 2 years sober, and I'm working with Lucky Eddie, and I'm getting married to a woman with three kids. My father had passed away. We're about to buy a house I can't afford to handle this new tribe, right? And I'm dry, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm reading the big book in 86 through 88, and I'm calling my sponsor, but there's just something off. And I meet up with my sponsor for lunch, and I tell him what's going on, and he threw a solution at me, you know, like he's supposed to, right? And I said, you know, I really don't think that's what I need right now, but thanks anyway. And he was pissed off, and he got up and left. And I thought, oh shit, what am I going to do now? I just started a new job and I had a new cellular phone. It was in a bag. I'm aging myself, a bag phone, but I had to have it. And I'm dialing people from my car in AA and no one's picking up, you know, and I did a day and a half of that. Finally, I got a call back from this guy who always wanted to be my sponsor. And he said, why don't you meet me for a salad? And it was a couple days because he was traveling. So I went to meetings, but I just kept my mouth shut. And I met him for a salad. And I remember praying before I went in. I said, God, please just help me to be honest with this man. And so we get there and go up to the salad bar. And we sit down and he looks at me and he says, so what's going on? And I had this moment of truth where I looked him in the eye and tears started coming out. And at 2 years sober, I'm saying, Nick, I'm dying inside. And that was my truth at that moment. I was dying inside. And he said, well, what's going on? And I told him everything that was going on. And he said, let's finish up here and go to my house. Went to his house and kind of did a 12-step out of the big book, even though we were going to meetings together and everything, right? And I said, you know, I always wanted you to be my sponsor. And he said, and I said, but you never raised your hand on Wednesday. And he said, well, you know, I sponsor a lot of guys. I didn't raise my hand because they were bussing people in from corrections and all the people who needed temporary sponsors. And he said, I'd raise my hand and I'd get eight, nine calls the next day and then I never hear from anybody. So I said, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yes. And that started a 21-year relationship with a man who knew everything about me, knew everything about my family, knew everything about my wife and her first marriage, knew everything about our kids. And he walked me through the steps and he walked me through sponsoring other men. And I loved him like a father. And I was living out of town when he passed away, but I know that he's with me today. You know, and he here's his deal. And here's what he had that I wanted, is he was able to be the same person in every situation. There was a degree of humility about him that he gained through working the 12 steps and sponsoring other men through the steps that allowed him to be the same Nick in every situation, personal, professional, tragic, joyful, the same person. And I've never been able to do that. And I could never do that. I was always the guy who would be who you needed me to be at that moment, right? And I just, he would just look at me and he'd say, Ray, get real. You know, and I'm like, I'm trying. And he'd say, Ray, lighten up. Because at 2 years of sobriety, man, I was still really serious and taking myself real seriously. One, I was working in media sales. And one day I had this presentation in front of, I don't know if there's any insurance people on the call. I don't mean to insult anyone, but I was ready to do this presentation in front of a group of insurance people, right? And back in the day, it was like if polyester was a disease, these guys would be like dying, right? And they were old school, right? And I remember calling Nick and I said, Nick, I got this presentation. I'm just scared to death. I think I'm going to poop my pants. I'm so nervous. And he said to me, he said, well, Ray, just be yourself. And again, I had a moment of clarity with that man. And I said, Nick, I don't know who that is. And he said, do you want to find out? And I said, yes. And we started the four-step inventory. So I was able to find the truth about myself at that moment, which wasn't really great. They defined someone just like Nick to be my sponsor. And I was living in Wilmington, North Carolina, and I couldn't find Nick there. And we moved to Carlsbad, California, and I couldn't find Nick there. We moved to San Luis Obispo, California, and I couldn't find Nick there. But I had sponsors. I had a sponsor in Carlsbad and San Luis, but I'm still looking for Nick. And then we moved to Hilton Head. And I found Nick in the form of a gentleman by the name of John Holmes, not the porn star, but John Holmes, the retired executive who had 40 plus years of sobriety and was sponsored by Sandy Beach. And John, I went to this men's group when I first got into town, and John was talking about what it was like losing a sponsor. Before he had Sandy, he had lost a sponsor, and how hard it was to find another sponsor when you had built up a level of trust in a relationship, and how desperately you look for that same level of trust in a relationship and admiration and love. And he said, it doesn't exist. And he's the cat I went up to after and said, is this your number? Can I call you tomorrow? And he said, yeah. And so I called him the next day, which he said he was really surprised. And we met for lunch, and he 12-stepped me. You know, I'm like, you know, I've got 14 some years of sobriety at the time. He 12-stepped me just out of the big book. It was amazing, right? And I knew what he was doing. And it felt really good because I knew what he was doing, and I was watching him, and I was going to school on him. We started a relationship until he passed away. And then I picked up another sponsor. So my sobriety has brought me to being a family man in some respects, where I married a woman with three kids. You know, and when I married that woman and three kids in Minnesota, you know, people would say to me, oh my God, you're just, you know, what a great guy for you to marry this woman, you know, and raise these three kids. And I told them the truth. I said, I'm the lucky one. Because first of all, the woman is amazing. I don't know if she's Harmony's sponsor still, but I know she was for a long time. And the three kids are awesome. You know, the oldest was like 9. The youngest was like a year, right? And we became a real happy family, you know, based on the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous. We were the family where everyone came. We're the family where we burned out coffee pots, because people would come over at any time to have coffee and talk about Alcoholics Anonymous. And there was points when I was writing inventory every year, and I always had the same fear, you know, and that fear was, I'm going to grow old alone. And it was a real fear for me, man. It's like, I'm never going to find my soulmate or whatever. And when I married this kid and we had the three kids, you know, this God working through the sixth and seventh step, that fear went away. And then the fear was, oh my God, I'm never going to be alone again. You know, I had these little kids following me all over the place, but it was really my gift. It was really my joy. You know, we traveled the world with the kids. We're two professional athletes of the children. Our youngest son was a 2006 Winter Olympian in the men's super pipe. He placed 4th. There may have been some politics, but he was crushed to be the 4th best in the world. You know, and 3 years ago, that same kid who was a professional athlete for 12 years and made more money than I did, was sitting in my living room, and I'm 12-stepping him in a really harsh way of telling him the truth, that other than your family, you're homeless, you spent all your money, you don't have any relationships, you know, you're heading down a path that's going to lead to death. And he was in a position to hear that. And the family helped him, you know, and it was tough because the family's like, well, you know, we're living in Charleston at the time. And he said, well, let's send him up to, there's a good place in Greenville. I'm like, no, this guy needs to go away. He does not need any family around him at all. And he made a commitment. Well, first of all, I tricked him. I said, you know, he'd call me all drunk, like, oh, my life, it's terrible, all this, like we do, right? And then I'd say, well, come on, see us, you know. And he finally said, okay. So I sent him a one-way ticket, and he was so out of it, he didn't notice that there wasn't a return ticket because he wasn't going back. And so he made a commitment to go to this six-month facility called Bridges of Hope. And a couple things happened. One, he was ready. And two, the director there got a hold of him. And as Mason said, his name is Mason, as Mason said, he finally made recovery look cool. And I'm like, dude, me and your mom have been sober for a long time. We never made it look cool, you know? Obviously not. And they shoved the big book up every orifice of his body. And he went in and he just celebrated 3 years of sobriety. And he is a pillar in the AA community. And he's sponsoring guys and he's in meetings and he's reinventing himself. Right now he's a real successful barber, you know, and that's what he wanted to do. His career was gone. You know, all of his money was gone. And I loved that kid. And I knew when we had that conversation in our living room, two things were going to happen. He was either going to go and get help, or he was never going to talk to me again, because that's the risk you take. And he went. And I'm just so grateful that the perfect people were in his path, got him where he needed to be. And he worked his ass off. And I remember driving on the way out. You know, we picked him up after 6 months, and we'd go up there every weekend. And, you know, it was like 4.5 hours one way. We'd go up there almost every weekend. And we're driving out, you know, and he starts crying in my front seat. And I said, buddy, what's wrong? And he said, it's just the first thing I finished in a long time. You know, if you're an alcoholic, you might be able to relate to that. Aren't we great starters, you know? And he was really touched that he finally finished something, you know? And we go to meetings today, and it's just amazing. I'm coming up on 7:50. So we ended up in Hilton Head, and we were coming up to Charleston, Mount Pleasant, because our daughter, Maddie, lived here. And I married a woman with three kids, and we had one together. And the youngest one is Madeline. She's 28 now. And she's my favorite. And I always tell the kids, well, hands down, she's my favorite. And they always go, well, why is she your favorite? I'm like, because she was always nice to me. You guys never figured that out. So we were coming up on weekends to see her and go to church, actually, because there was a great church up here. And there was an opportunity for us to move up here out of Hilton Head. Hilton Head's great. Hilton Head's lovely. But I'm telling you, people move to Hilton Head to die. It's like we were there in our 50s, and we brought the median age down quite a bit. You know what I mean? And so we moved up to Charleston, got connected into AA. And every community that we've moved to, AA has always been the foundation. It's where we go first. It's where we find the barber. It's where we find the hairdresser. It's where we find the grocery store. It's where we find the attorney. It's where we find the realtor. I mean, you're our people. This is where we go. You're the foundation. We make AA the foundation, and everything sprouts up from that foundation. And we did the same thing in Charleston. You know, so we moved up here. My wife had 28 years of sobriety. I had 29 years of sobriety. And we're raising our hands saying, you know, I'm Ray. I'm an alcoholic. I just moved here. You know, and I felt like a newcomer. Every community we go to, I felt like a newcomer. But, you know, we were willing to take that risk because we knew our lives depended upon it. You know, so we've made Alcoholics Anonymous the foundation of our lives. And I'm telling you, you know, I love being long-term sobriety. Absolutely love it. But my experience is I have not gone through 33 years of sobriety without some issues, you know, without some hard work, without some pain. And the last year, there was a lot of pain in our family. And some of it was caused by me, you know, and I had to take responsibility for that. You know, and along the path of sobriety, I've made decisions based on self, and I've made decisions based on instincts that have not worked out well for me and other people. You know, and I had to clean up a mess, and I'm going to continue to clean up a mess. You know, and those times are really hard, but as I tell my guys, that's where we meet God. You know, I mean, I'm pretty spiritual when things are going my way, you know, but when things aren't going my way and I pause long enough, I meet God again. And I meet God at a different level, and I meet God in a different perspective than I had maybe 24 hours before. You know, so I still have the ability to cause harm among people that I love, you know, in a form of alcoholism, in a form of self, in a form of manifestation of my alcoholism, you know? So it's like a daily reprieve. It's like, you know, the spiritual condition of that moment, you know? It's like spiritual principles. I was raised with the belief of the four absolutes of honesty, purity, unselfishness, and love. And when I act out from those principles, and when I make decisions based on those principles, I live under the safety and security of the umbrella of God. And when I don't, I'm on my own. You know, people talk about a God thing. To me, it's all a God thing. You know, not just when it's good. Oh, it's a God wink. It's like, it's all a God wink, right? So I want to tell you a little bit of my home group. So when you come to Mount Pleasant, you know where it is, right? It's right up the 17. It's old school AA. I learned this out in California. We do tickets. Right, it's a ticket meeting. You show up to the meeting, you get a ticket. The chairperson does an 8-minute lead from the big book. No other book. It's the big book. And we've had people try only to get shut down because it's not the big book. And after that 8-minute lead, the chairperson draws a ticket. And if your ticket's called, you can either share or you can pass. And the way we did that in California, because the meetings are so large, is that you'd get every week Steve. You know, you'd get the cat that's got something to say every week. So now we're shutting every week Steve off. And I'll tell you, a few times that we did this in California and a few times that we did this in my home group, is I've heard a real small voice say, I've been going to meetings for quite a while and this is the first time I've shared. And I'm like, oh God, right? Isn't that just awesome? So then we go a little bit more old school. In our format, we say, we don't chant with the 12th step and the 12th tradition when they're read. And I'm telling you, people only make that mistake once. And it's interesting when they make that mistake at that meeting, you can see how rote it is. They're not even thinking about what's being read. They just know that at this time they say, practicing principles before personalities, right? No chanting in our meeting, right? And then we make a really big, I don't want to say issue, some people think I'm a little dramatic, but we make a real big conscious effort to make sure that no one's on their cell phones in our home group. You know, we subscribe, our group conscious subscribes that there is nothing so important that's going to happen within the next hour that it's worth risking being able to save someone or being able to hear God speak to someone. And trust me, this was not easy for me. I have to leave my cell phone in my car when I go to my home group because it'll ring, it'll tingle, it'll buzz, it'll flash. And the next thing I know, I'm not in the meeting anymore, but I'm talking to some cat client of mine in Oskaloosa, you know? And so we're trying to bring back a real pure message of Alcoholics Anonymous and give everyone an opportunity to be present, to experience the miracle in a meeting, which we believe is the Spirit of God that's attending that meeting. So I'm at 7:57. I want to tell you that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. If my story didn't show it, then I'm going to tell you, I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love what it's done for me. I love what it's done for my family. I love what it's done for the guys I work with. I go to meetings because there's a wholesale miracle, right? I'm a church guy. I'm a church guy and I love our church, but I don't see that miracle of healing in the church like I see in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't see people sharing at that level of honesty and transparency with the sole purpose of helping another person that I see in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. So, David, thank you so much for the opportunity to spend an hour with you. And I'm really grateful. And thank you for listening.
Ah, thank you so much. Everybody, you have the privilege of unmuting. And thanking Ray. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Ray. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to take the meeting back. Thank you so much. That was magnificent. We're going to give Ray just a couple minutes here. We'll give him a break and pass the seven tradition basket. The seven tradition states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. There's a link in the chat to our PayPal account. Simple Actions does contribute to Tidewater Intergroup, AAVirginia.org, General Service Office, and District 14, Norfolk. Feel free to click on that as you see fit. Also, as you think of questions that you'd like for our wonderful speaker to answer when we reconvene in a few minutes, please chat those to the user questions. Our brother Larry is sitting there waiting for them. So while contributions cover each group's rent and other expenses, the seventh tradition is essential at every level of AA service. It is both a privilege and a responsibility for groups and members to ensure that not only their group, but also their intergroup, central office, local services, district, area, and general service office remain self-supporting. This keeps AA free of outside influences that might divert us from our primary purpose to help the alcoholic who still suffers. Our common welfare, a word about safety. Our group endeavors to provide a safe meeting place for all attendees and encourages each person here to contribute to fostering a secure and welcoming environment in which our meeting can take place. I would be happy to take a couple of announcements by show of hand. All righty. That offer is still good, but I'm going to continue to read the simple actions is, Beverly. Beverly, can you raise your virtual hand? Because it's hard to find you in the queue if you don't. Go ahead.
Hi, I'm Bev. Riskin is having their, I believe it's 25th anniversary on July 22nd. And they're having a speaker, 8 o'clock Wednesday. I think it's July 22nd. Harmony can tell you more.
Okay, well, we got Harmony in the queue. Thanks. Harmonious.
Harmony Alcoholic. Thank you, Beverly. That's so nice. That's not even your home group. West End is having their, we're having an anniversary speaker on July 22nd at 8 p.m. Marion W. from Boca Raton, Florida. It should be another great talk like the ones we've been having here at Simple Actions. And I hope you guys can log on for that. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, anybody else? Simple Actions is a home group. If you're interested in joining our home group or in need of a sponsor, please hang out after the meeting. Home group members, please raise your hands. Sponsorship in Alcoholics Anonymous is yours for the asking. We urge you do not delay. If you have questions or would like additional information about sponsorship, we'll be available here after we close this meeting. Please stick around. You may have come in alone. You do not have to leave that way. Or if you're shy, feel free to send an email to info@simpleactions.net. All righty. So we've got several questions coming in, but please keep them coming, guys. Ray, that was amazing. I'm sorry I messed you up by pumping my fist at the white powder. were you high school class of 1979?
I was.
Me too, brother.
Barely, but yeah.
Yeah. Grew up in the 70s, right?
That's right.
thank you again. It was just magnificent.
Thank you.
So our first question is, you lived in different cities all over the country. What type of meetings are your favorite? And any tips for finding a new AA community after a move?
That's a great question. My favorite's always literature-based, preferably big book, but I don't mind 12-step and 12 tradition. And then the speaker meeting. Sometimes I think the speaker meeting is, well, not sometimes. I think the speaker meeting is the purest form of AA. You know, it allows the identification, and it also provides a message of hope. You know, so, and it's really hard to not be honest and transparent when you're telling your story. But I do like the big book meetings too, because you can't really BS around the big book. And I do like the 12 steps and 12 tradition meetings because, again, they're literature based. So when we have moved into a new community, we look for a club first. We're kind of club people. And then we look for literature based meetings. By taking that risk and raising your hand and introducing yourself as just moved here, you know, the hope always is that someone will come in or someone will come after the meeting and introduce themselves. And it usually happens, you know, and that's always good. And then, you know, the conversation lends to, well, what other meetings do you go to? You know, so that's how I would answer that.
Great. All right. And let's see. Second question we have is, what actions do you think we can do to connect with newcomers during this pandemic?
Boy, that's another really good question. You know, I'm gonna go into what I do in the meetings I go to is, you know, I'm gonna extend the hand of AA. And the way I can do that during the pandemic is, you know, with a phone number, but I'd rather, if they're comfortable, the guy giving me the number ensures that I'll eventually talk to him versus just taking their number. You know, and then again, that identification that, you know, this whole program was built on knee-to-knee communication, sharing experience, strength, and hope. You know, you go back to Ebby and Bill, you know, and I think that that's where we need to go during this, you know, whether it's social distance, which is not really that hard, you know, and wearing a mask. But, you know, when anyone reaches out for help, we want the hand of AA always to be there. So we might have to get a little uncomfortable. We might have to get out of our comfort zone to usher that new person in, you know, and then hopefully this, you know, this won't last forever, you know, and I hope when I was talking about that I didn't discount anybody who has had a hard time during this pandemic, because it's been difficult for a lot of people, you know, including me with my business. It's been really difficult, you know, and so I really cling to the Zoom meetings. And I tell you, you know, if I'm a 4 or 5 face-to-face meeting a week guy, I got to be doing 6 or 7 Zooms, because I just need that. You know, I need to be connecting. And I'm really rabid with the newcomer. Like, I go after them. Like, people went after for me. So I hope that helps.
Thank you. Let's see. You mentioned that both you and your wife are in AA. Any direction from your experience for those of us in relationships with other people in the program?
Lawyer up.
So always sponsor her.
You know, relationships are where you learn. That's been my experience, man. The relationships are where you learn the truth about yourself. You know, we had on our refrigerator for years, until it got folded up and crinkled, the line out of the big book says, "We avoid argument and fault finding like the plague." You know, we had that on our refrigerator. You know, it's not, I've got enough to deal with myself than to think that I'm going to offer any assistance to anyone else I'm in a relationship with, you know, but man, I'm telling you, that's where you learn. You look at Harmony and Grant, those cats are learning a lot every day, but that's where you learn. Don't, you know, and if you can, don't run from it, you know. Work through it, because either you deal with it now or you deal with it later, because the relationship stuff doesn't go away. That's my experience.
Thank you. Let's see. How did you come to know and appreciate the four absolutes, and what actions stem from them in your sobriety today?
Well, they were literally crammed down my throat in Duluth, Minnesota by strong sponsorship. You know, we went to meetings and they were up on the wall, you know. The Akron group still produces a pamphlet on the four absolutes. It's not in the big book, you know. So I was sponsored into the four absolutes. And, you know, the way I practice them today, I can tell you, well, I'll answer the question. The way I practice them today is I use them in my decision-making process. Is it pure? Is it loving? Is it unselfish? Is it true? You know, and so it's almost like you run your stuff past the four absolutes. In your relationships, in your business. You know, Nick, my sponsor, I remember calling him 1 year. It's, you know, and I was talking about my taxes. I'm like, well, I got a gray area in my taxes. And he says, well, there's no such thing as a gray area. I'm like, well, this one kind of is. He says, well, what's your upside? And I said, like, $1,200. And he said, huh, is it worth taking a drink over? No, right? So the Four Absolutes gets incorporated into everything that you do, right? So if you're like me, an alcoholic like me, it's like sometimes I want to shoot an angle, you know? And the dangerous part is if I shoot an angle and I get away with it, I'm shooting more angles, right? So I'm living today with consequences of not living within the Four Absolutes in the last couple of years of my life. And I'm grateful to be sober, but it was a really hard lesson to learn. So I hope that answers that question.
Thank you. Also, we have had a request from one of the newcomer men for men's telephone numbers. So if you are a man willing to pass your number on, please text that to questions, and it'll get passed along to the new man. Let's see. Ray, do you take sponsees through the traditions and the concepts?
I do take sponsees through the traditions after the steps, and take them through the traditions with how they can incorporate those traditions into their lives. It's funny because you have great conversations about being self-supporting. Concepts, I will be honest, I am not that familiar. I got into general service at a real early age and kind of was working my way up in the ranks and it appeared to be an ego-feeding proposition. And then I married a woman with three kids. And my sponsor suggested that maybe my service work should be at home. So I have the concepts as a book, but I'm not that familiar with the concepts, so I would not be qualified to take anyone through the concepts.
Yeah, I can do about 2 minutes on the right of decision and then I'm out of bullets. Let's see. You mentioned some of the guidelines for your meeting in Mount Pleasant. Do you celebrate AA anniversaries there?
We not only celebrate AA anniversaries, but AA anniversaries are celebrated with marbles, ding-dongs, and a hug. We don't give chips. We give marbles. We often say when we're giving marbles that while we were out there, we lost our marbles, and now that we're here, we can regain our marbles. We have different colored marbles for different years or different months, and blue marbles, ding-dongs, and hugs for year anniversaries. Rule 62.
And the ding-dongs are like the little Twinkie cake thing?
Yeah, little Twinkie cake. The good news about them is they're chock full of preservatives, so you buy a couple boxes, they last forever.
Yeah, right on. that's cool. Let's see. We're coming to the end of the questions, guys.
That's great.
Unless you want to hear the questions that I want. What does character building mean to you?
Oh, wow. Ooh, that's a great question. I think character building for me means doing the right thing at the right time for the right intent. And from that, character is built versus not, and there is no character to be built there.
Let's see. Has service work at any level contributed to your sobriety and life in general?
Absolutely. And not so, as I mentioned about my general service experience. So my service commitments have been at the group level. Whether I started a home group like the Happy Hour group, where I do all my service work, or any home group that I've been involved in, I've done service work. So yeah, it adds to my life a lot. You know, anytime I can be thinking about another alcoholic is a brief moment of not thinking about myself. You know, I kind of thought that with 10 years of sobriety, the self-obsession would lessen. To a degree it has, but it's still so prevalent in my life. So service work offers me an opportunity to get out of that self-obsession and to show action into something that someone else is going to benefit from, which is ironic because I benefit also.
All right. Would you be willing to describe an experience with step 6 and 7?
Oh, sure. So most recently, steps 6 and 7 through the inventory process showed up in my drive and in my instincts. And this last year has brought those two things to a different level than I've had before. The first time I did an inventory with Dickie B, I went home and did the 6 and 7 step as outlined in the big book. Like, I literally put the book on the shelf and then took it off. I've never sat for an hour. Okay. I'll tell Bob next week, but I've never sat for an hour. But at that first time through, it seemed like everything that I was willing to have God remove was just like coming right at me. Like, for a period of time, it was so ironic. It almost felt like, are you sure? You know, because there they were just like glaring, and it's like, what's going on here? You know, I was entirely willing. I was on my knees. I did that 7-step prayer, but there they were. The lesson I took out of that is that you know, I have a part in the 6 and 7 step as well. You know, I have an opportunity to change my behavior. You know, I have an opportunity to think in a different way. I have an opportunity to live out from a different perspective, you know. So I've had some pretty good experiences with 6 and 7, and I've adopted some different ways of doing 6 and 7. I'll just share, you know, I don't know if it's the group conscience or whatever, but about 10 years ago, I started writing out the definition of my defects. And then I would write out the opposites of the defects and definition of that. And then I would take a daily inventory to see how things were going with those defects of character. What I learned from that is not really knowing the definition of some of those defects didn't really allow me to have a complete understanding of what I was really.
Looks like we've lost Ray for the moment. This happened when he was talking, but he came back pretty quickly. Is everybody having the same experience I am? Yeah, okay, I see nodding, thumbs up, thank you. Right on. We've got his sponsor, Bob Darrell, next week, by the way, from Las Vegas. So he'll be here next Sunday. Should we tell Bob that he wasn't wearing pants when he came tonight? Oh, thank you. Somebody smiled. Good. That may be a wrap, kids. I will. I'll just continue with the format here. And if our brother Ray drops back in, we'll let him finish. So the only thing that I have left to say is thank you for all who participated. After the Lord's Prayer, I'll give everybody the opportunity to unmute and thank the speaker. This is awesome when things go off the rails. All right. So let's do this.
I'm sorry about that. I lost my internet for just a second.
We got you, Ray.
Sorry about that.
You're good.
Did I finish? Am I done? Did we get a question from Harmony or Grant?
We still got some time. You were in the middle of, talking about 6 and 7 and the definitions of defects and stuff.
Oh, yeah. So I have a better understanding of what it is that I'm being entirely willing to be rid of. You know, and it's subtle. They're subtle. It's like. Oh gosh, there's still so much self-obsession. There's so much self-gain. There's so much, like, am I really trusting God with my security? you know, what kind of angle am I shooting to get what I want? You know, it's just that they can be really subtle. So understanding the definitions of the defects and then understanding the definitions of the opposite of those defects gives me something to strive for. And yet that sounds like I'm doing it, but I believe that God wants me to be involved in this process. It's not a miracle prayer and boom, they're all gone. That has not been my experience. What I've been given is I've been giving some time in between that allows me to act and react differently, where before the action and reaction was just automatic. I had no control over it.
All right. We had a question about sponsorship. Because you talked about several special sponsors. By the way, we have Bob D is coming next week to do this Sunday night meeting for us.
Make sure he's wearing a tie.
Well, I'm going to tell him you were wearing a tie, and I'm going to tell him you were wearing pants.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. if there's just anything you'd care to share about sponsorship, what drew you to those guys? You're having an experience sponsoring others that you'd like to share. Just anything about sponsorship you might like to share.
Those guys all had what I wanted. You know, I just hated myself so much when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I would have traded places with anybody. You know, I just hated myself. And I've always been drawn to the guys that have a degree of humility like Nick did, where he was just the same person in every situation. You know, sponsorship today is a give and take. You know, I'm only going to get out of my sponsor what I'm willing to put into that relationship. I'd like to think, and you can ask Bob in the questions next week if I'm still sponsorable, but I think I am, because I still get myself in a shitload of trouble, right? So I think I am still sponsorable. You know, and me working with guys, you know, so I've lightened up a lot. I was like the really hard sponsor for a long time. It's like, you know, we have requirements. This came out of Duluth, Minnesota. A minimum of 4 meetings a week. Call me every day for a while. And for a while is like the caveat. And the answer to that, if you ever run into this, is that as soon as you ask, do I still have to call you every day? You probably don't. Read the big book every day and I'll show you where to read it, and then work the steps 1 through 12. And when you get through 12, you should be working with another man, right? So that's the sponsor requirements. So I throw that out and I say, if you're willing to do these things, I'm willing to work with you. But if you decide at any time that you're not willing to do those things, then you've ended the relationship. Because I don't believe in firing, but I also don't believe in chasing, right? So except for newcomers, I chase newcomers. So that's worked really well for me. Now, call me every day for a while. They miss a couple of days. I've missed a couple of days. You know, it's not that rigid. But, you know, there's got to be that willingness to go to any lengths. I have found nothing convenient about sobriety and recovery. Not one thing. Maybe Zoom, because I'm wearing swim trunks right now, right? But there's nothing convenient about recovery, you know, and it just doesn't happen. You got to work for it, right? So I think the identification, getting the person to identify early on as an alcoholic, it's our job to qualify them. It's not their job. It's our job to qualify them out of the big book on what an alcoholic is defined as. Maybe they're a drug addict. I don't know if I can help them if they're a drug addict. I know I can help them if they're a real alcoholic. So I just kind of go through that. I go through the bedevilments, you know, and I ask the million-dollar question, are you experiencing that now without drinking? They're like, yeah. I'm like, okay, you know. So then we put out some requirements. It's a basis of the relationship, but it's all on them. You know, it's all on them. But I think it's the greatest gift in my life, other than kids, to be able to hold another man's hand on your knees and do the third step. Where does that happen, you know? And then to be a part of their lives and to watch them, you know, bloom, to watch them get married, have kids, their careers. I mean, aren't we lucky that we get to do that. And for me, the only thing I did to gain that was destroy everything in my life. That's what brought me to my knees of being able to be of service to other people. It's the greatest gift, right? I love it. Like, I always wanted to sponsor Harmony, but up in Minnesota, there was that boys sponsor boys and girls sponsor girls. Although in California, it gets a little loose, and in Vegas, it gets a little loose too, but she never asked me.
Well, by request of the our speaker tonight, Harmony, would you like to ask our speaker a question tonight, and then we'll close the meeting?
I've already asked about a gabillion on here, like that's that. But Ray, like, you know, you talked a lot about, or a little bit about the kids. But you were, I mean, they went from being like little. We're talking like 2 or 3 to being grown ups. And like, what were some of the like the challenges with the kiddos that you guys faced? I know you talk about Mason, but.
Yeah, thank you. That's a great question, man. It was tough. I brought what I knew about parenting into the relationship. And the only thing I knew about parenting is what I experienced from my own parents. You know, my wife was really good about, you know, grabbing me some books, taking me to, like PTA speakers that would talk about parenting. And I made a lot of mistakes. You know, my first surrender is that they already have a dad. You know, they didn't sign up for 2 dads. So once I got that surrender, then my role became really fun. You know, I can be the happy uncle guy, right? You know, and so the roles changed a little bit. Now they used to call me Sergeant Carter because I was like a disciplinarian. Like, our kids had chores, right? And that's just the way I was brought up, you know? And for some reason I gave Maddie, the youngest, she had to bring the glass milk bottles to the bottom of the basement steps. Very few ever made it because she would drop them about halfway. I don't know what I was thinking there, but they thought I was a real disciplinarian. But then through the process of the steps, you know, and getting some help in some other areas, the relationship developed more into friends, a confidant, you know, someone that they could trust. I didn't always have to have the answers. The best thing I learned when the kids were young is some John Rosemont was his name, and he used to publish something in the newspaper about parenting. And I do this sometimes with my sponsees, you know. It's always sad, never mad. Like, oh, that's so hard. That must be so hard. What do you think we can do about it? You know, but it was the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous and being a sober man that really helped. Otherwise, I'm sure I would have jacked those kids up real bad, you know? And it was hard. It was a lot of work. But what a gift. What a gift of sobriety. You know, I get to be a dad to these 3 awesome kids. That never would have happened if I was drinking or drugging, you know, so it's just another gift. But it's a great question, you know, and I'd be more than happy to help if anyone's in that situation, because it can be real consuming mentally to deal with that stuff. Had to throw a hard one, didn't you?
All right. Thank you, Ray. I'm afraid we are out of time. We're going to, Leanne's going to read the last 3 paragraphs on page 164. We will all pray. And then after the prayer, you guys will have the opportunity to unmute yourselves and thank Ray for a wonderful meeting. Thank you all again for everyone who participated, who made this possible. Thank Larry for wrangling the questions, and just you for being here tonight. Leanne?
Thanks so much, Ray. A vision for you. Our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation what you can do each day for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order. But obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right. and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to Him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until then.
Thank you. Let's make a virtual circle and have a moment of silence to do with as you wish, followed by the Lord's Prayer. Our Father.
Our Father.
Who art in heaven. Hallowed be thy name. Thy kingdom come. Thy will be done. On earth as it is in heaven. Give us this day our daily bread. And forgive us our trespasses. As we forgive those who trespass against us. And lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. For thine is the kingdom, the power, and the glory, forever and ever.
Amen.